Choosing where to go to university is a big commitment.
By choosing to study at the University of Central Lancashire, you'll be choosing a place that will support you as you step into your future.
You'll be choosing a new place to call home.
We see our students for who they are and who they can be.
We see opportunity.
We see potential.
We see you.
There's still time to apply for a degree through Clearing.
Visit uclan.ac.uk/clearing to find out more.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I am your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for listening and downloading today's podcast. This week we saw a terrific game between Chelsea and Liverpool and a result nobody saw coming. A true underdog result where a ragtag bunch of unknown players comprehensively beat a footballing institution. I'm talking, of course, about West Brom's win over West Ham United. In order to discuss those results and other games, I am joined by my two best friends in the world who have promised me that they will not be criticizing Manchester United tonight, Morgan Green and Chris Hennage. Welcome to the podcast, guys. So, Chris, we know you're out in New York City right now. What have you been up to? What have you been doing this trip? Did you catch any MLS games?
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, I was at New York City FC v Dallas last night, which was a cracking game. Even Oscar Pereira said it was a really good advert for the league, which I'm inclined to agree with. Outside of that, keeping abreast of everything to do with the Premier League and Europe. But yeah, it doesn't take a break, even though you kind of get away from the hub of it all. You're still able to stay connected, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, and you were thinking you might get some time off, you know, some vacation. Nope. None of that. Always watching.
Not even close.
Always watching football. To be honest, like even if you were on vacation, and this is true for me, even if I was on vacation, I would never stop watching football. So it's just the greatest love of my life. All right, guys. So let's get into talking about this week. Well, let's start, Morgan, with Chelsea versus Liverpool. According to your Twitter, Morgan, you had a lot of thoughts on how Chelsea would comprehensively beat Liverpool, but what happened, Morgan?
They did not comprehensively beat Liverpool. That's really kind of boiled down to there. I mean, I really thought that, you know, Conte, given all of his tactical genius and everything, I thought he would have handled the Liverpool onslaught a lot better. But again, too, you got to kind of put that down to the players as well. They just, in the first half of everything I saw, now again, I was at work for it, so I caught bits and pieces. But from everything I read, all the stats I saw, it just kind of fell apart and kind of bowed to that Liverpool pressure in the first half. It could have been a lot worse. Really, when I think about it, at least, Jordan Henderson scored once in 5 years old. Doing a Luka Modric impression. So, I mean, or that, you know, they really could have come away with a draw. And I think that, you know, to me, at least in the second half, when Chelsea was massively better, as a Chelsea fan, that would have been huge for us. But, really, it's very disappointing that they kind of came out the way they did. And, you know, David Luiz played as best as he could, which was good to see from him. Game, even though he kind of came back because of John Terry's injury. So disappointing overall, but again, they'll go forward and they'll have next time to beat him at Anfield.
Now, Chris, I mean, Morgan's trying to get away from Chelsea and we're going to nail him. He's trying to deflect the attention onto Liverpool, but we're going to nail him about Chelsea in a second. But he did bring up Henderson, and I wonder if this is a pivotal moment for Henderson. An exceptional goal, one of the goals, it'll go down as one of the goals of the season. And I remember, the reason I say this is I remember a couple of pivotal moments in Gerrard's career, because he took over as captain of Liverpool very early. He took over from Sami Hupia. He was 22, 23 at the time. I remember him tracking, outplaying Patrick Vieira, and Patrick Vieira in his pomp at the peak of Patrick Vieira's powers. Have we seen a pivotal moment like that in Henderson's career? Because he really has divided opinion overall.
He has. I think this is one moment, but I think, as you alluded to in the question there were moments, plural, for Gerrard. And I think that's what Henderson needs. I think the benefit he has at the minute is the style they're trying to play is very conducive to his talents, which for me, I'm not looking to diminish his technical abilities as much as say that I think his physical aspects and assets are the most important in his game. His ability to run, his ability to get from both ends of the field, not only quickly, but consistently through that 90 minutes. And we talk about the rock and roll or heavy metal football that Jurgen Klopp talks about. That's ideal for someone like him. I think the technical side, I think he's always been a strong technician with essentially peaks of supreme technical ability, which is what we saw against Chelsea. It, as is often the case, and I think we could apply this to not just Jordan Henderson, but a good portion of that Liverpool squad.
Mm-hmm.
Can consistency be achieved? That's the only thing I think holding them back from a Premier League title at this point is consistency. How you achieve that can come in a variety of ways. There's an interesting debate, I think, to be had at some point about confidence and how influential confidence is in achieving consistency, and whether the ability of Sadio Mane and his just kind of energy and game-changing ability will raise them in the same way that Luis Suarez did.
Morgan, Chris brings up some awesome points there. And we need to, I think it's a perfect transition for what we need to get into, because Chris points out the fact that, points out the idea that, you know, this Liverpool team has the potential under Klopp to be champions of, to win the Premier League. And I think other managers, other teams need to recognize that in their first phase, when they come out of the blocks, they are exceptionally good. They're great out of the blocks. The first 20 minutes, 25 minutes, they are going to dominate teams that might be quote unquote better than them on paper. Yet manager after manager keeps falling to this, instead of trying to absorb that pressure, instead of trying to get past that point, every manager tries to play a different game against Liverpool. They lose goals over and over again, and then gets to the point that they've lost too many goals by the time Liverpool tire, which is around the 40th minute mark. And there's that gap for like 30 minutes where Liverpool are essentially there to be had. And they're very vulnerable. So that's the problem for me, why I don't think Liverpool are contenders. And I don't understand why more managers are not taking advantage of this obvious flaw.
Well, I think you have to look at it in a couple of ways. The first way, and I can see it from a team that has if you look at a team that has exceptional attacking talent, you can think, okay, we know they're going to come at us hard and fast, but if we can nick a goal, we can take them out of their game. If we get that early goal, we can take them out, and I think that we can do that. I think that's something that runs through a lot of teams' minds when they come up against Liverpool, is to try and score early. Rattle their confidence, rattle their game, and try and make them change it. Unfortunately, we haven't really seen a team do that too much. I mean, we saw, the Arsenal game. There aren't a lot of teams. I think even if you do get that one early goal, I think this Liverpool team with Klopp has the confidence to look at it and say, okay, you got one, we're going to get two. And then the other thing you kind of look at it as is, do you really want to start the game soaking up that pressure, parking the bus, and possibly giving up a goal or two no matter what? Because, again, like you said, they do have Sadio Mane, some exceptional attacking talent, some exceptional attacking midfielders on there that even if you do try and soak up the pressure, there's still a good chance you give up at least one goal. So you're starting down that way. So it's really, it's kind of a negative in those two different ways. But like you said, I think there is a way that you can sit there and try and soak it up and just really play your luck. I think you'll see that happen more maybe against like a David Moyes side that might sit back, try and soak it up, try and get something on the counter around the 40th minute. It may work against a team like that. But for some reason, a lot of these, bigger teams, your Chelsea's, your City's, your Manchester United's, I wouldn't put them in a big team right now, but they're going to have that confidence of, okay, we're going to go out, we're going to establish ourselves, and we're going to get that early goal and knock their game, and it hasn't happened yet.
Chris, let's press on this again, because you always come up with really good analogies, and while Morgan was talking, I was trying to come up with one that I can think of. And the one that pops off to me from recent Olympics, I used to run track in college myself, so this is close to my heart. I think the only real tactical race in all of track is the 1500. It's the mile, right? in the mile, you have different kinds of runners. You have those who come out of push out the starting line hard and then kind of ease off and then try to kick at the end. You have those that sit at the back of the pack and wait for people to maneuver around, drag behind them, and then push right towards the front around the about 600 meters to go. Liverpool are definitely one of those that are pushing out really hard from the blocks. They're basically sprinting the first 400 meters, leaving everyone in their wake. And for whatever reason, no other manager is being able to understand that that's something that can be dealt with. You just let them get away. You let them, or you sort of just keep up with them, and eventually they're going to tire. And why is it? I'm curious. Why none of the great managers in the league? Conte. We have all these managers who keep name dropping every week. No one is being able to outthink Klopp right now with that.
I think I like your analogy a lot. Actually, I think where I would take it myself, based on kind of my own kind of understanding, is look at UFC with Conor McGregor.
What event did you run in track?
I didn't run any. Trust me, I watched.
okay, UFC.
And even then, I got tired. but if you look at Conor McGregor, he's someone that predominantly starts his fights very aggressively, very quickly, tries to shut them down in the first few rounds if he can. His style is quite intensive in terms of his stamina and what it does to his body. And if we look at that Nick Diaz fight, the one of the few fights where he's had to go five rounds, towards the end he was absolutely gassed. And it's a similar concept with Liverpool. They try to knock you out, so to speak, and steamroll you early on. And the difficulty is, much like some of McGregor's early opponents, it's very easy to say, well, can you not manage that? Can you not try and take him the distance? It can be difficult if he just catches you with one, in the same way that it can be difficult if Liverpool catch you with a goal, if they score inside the first 10 minutes, because then your kind of inclination is, okay, we need to try and get back into this. We need to start pushing them and seeing if we can engineer a goal for ourselves. So it's a game, I think against Liverpool, it's a game that needs to be meticulously managed from start to finish, almost in 10 to 15 minute chunks, which I don't know if that's something that's readily done across the league. In terms of, I think you actually need to plan, okay, and Alan Pardew used to do this sometimes against bigger teams. He would sit deep, really compact for 60 minutes, and then use the last 30 minutes as their opportunity to attack and go at the opponent. Now, that's not always the most eye-catching for a support, especially when you're playing at home, which is something he tended to do. And that's the difficulty, is that you're essentially almost admitting they're going to be the better team for a portion of this game, and we're going to let them be the better team in theory, but we're not going to let them score, because that's what will make them the better team when the final whistle goes.
Morgan, Chelsea were not the better team. Antonio Conte was not the better manager. Let's talk about that. We already talked about one thing that Conte got wrong and other managers have got wrong about Liverpool, which is not being cognizant of that first phase. The other one is at the end of the game, which are the fact that he waited until the 82nd, I think, minute to sub on the likes of Fabregas. And the game was crying out for Fabregas at 2-1. Why did he wait that long?
Buddy, your guess is as good as mine on there. And I'm shocked he didn't bring on Batshuayi.
Right.
Because he did need the goal.
He was warming up. I thought he was going to come on.
Exactly. And that was the one thing I thought. For me right now, what I see from these Antonio Conte teams is he hasn't changed a whole lot from last year, bar N'Golo Kanté starting over, Cesc Fabregas.
Yeah, but then the counterpoint to that, Morgan, is that that team is, again, not changed much from the team that won the Premier League two seasons earlier.
Exactly. But the change between then and now was the psychological damage done from last season. And I think why you're seeing this team kind of the way they are now, they've had brief glimpses of competency and dominance this year, but it's something, as you talked about, consistency. We haven't seen it consistently. I think Conte's done a very good job of getting Diego Costa's head right, as we see from him just scoring goals pretty much every game this year. I think Hazard has been a heck of a lot better since he came in, but there are still a lot of players, I think, that are still dealing with that hangover of Jose Mourinho last year, that 10th place finish last year. Nemanja Matic was particularly poor, I think. Oscar kind of reverted back to the kid running around the pitch, not really doing what he's supposed to be doing. Yeah, Thibaut Courtois, another player who in recent weeks has looked very weak.
He has regressed, hasn't he? Yeah.
It's very shocking to see how he's regressed.
Do you attribute that to anything beyond Mourinho? I mean, when Courtois came back and replaced Cech, he was exceptionally good. Then he had that injury, if I remember. He was out for 2 or 3 months, wasn't he? Is it something to do with that?
I don't know. I think it's a confidence thing. I think when he came back, he let in a couple of soft goals, and I think that he's just, it seems like his confidence just isn't quite there, and he's doing stuff that he shouldn't be doing. I'm hoping that with a little bit more work with the new goalkeeping coaches that have come in, they'll be able to get his head right. But I just think last year just really rocked this team to the core. And, you're still seeing them trying to get over that. I mean, the defense in particular, which has always been a Chelsea specialty, was the defense. And it's been very, very poor since pretty much all of last year.
Yeah.
Ivanovic, this is probably going to be his last year. And that's really the one, I would say the one positive is that you've got Kurt Zouma coming back, who was very good in my mind last year before his injury. You've got Andy Christensen coming back next year, who's been fantastic for Dortmund, and he's only 20 years old. For Mönchengladbach. There are changes coming to this team. The only question I have is that when it comes and you kind of take out those, the older guard, the shell-shocked guys, possibly Matic in January, what do you replace them with, and how does this team respond? And does Antonio Conte stay to, see out the finished product? If they don't finish in the top four, is his job safe? That's the biggest question.
Chris, I have to say that I thought Nemanja Matic had a pretty good game. I think Matic has been fairly good under Antonio Conte. I think he looks much better than he did last season. If I remember correctly, I think he was involved in the goal. He had the assist for the goal. I thought he was fine. What I do agree with Morgan on, Chris, is the issue at right back, with Ivanovic. And it makes me wonder why Cuadrado was let go, because on paper, Cuadrado is about as prototypical of an Antonio Conte fullback as there ever has been one.
I see your point. I think the difficulty is that Cuadrado is, to me at least, a bit more attacking-minded. And I think the issue for Chelsea, at least from a full-back perspective, hasn't really been what they do in the final third. It's what they do in their own defensive third. Now, an issue I think that Arsenal and Chelsea, funnily enough, have shared over these last few years is showing loyalty to the wrong players. One of the things I've always kind of admired about Chelsea and Abramovic, to the point of a fault almost, is that he's very pragmatic. He will get rid of someone, be it a coach, be it a player, when they've stopped serving a purpose. Now, there have been rare exceptions to that.
Is pragmatic a euphemism for ruthless now? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I would say that's okay. The word you use when, you don't want to get in trouble or anything like that. Okay. I think that ruthlessness has at times cost
pragmatism,
them.
Pragmatism, Chris, pragmatism.
Yes, that pragmatism has cost them, often when it has meandered into ruthlessness, shall we say.
Yeah.
And yet, like I said, there are these players who I think skipped through, and Ivanovic is a good case, and that's someone who, this is not the first time we've had the conversation about his sort of frailties and his lack of, I would say, ability to perform on that top level anymore. Mm-hmm. And yet they don't seem eager to kind of address it. I think they've tried to, by getting the likes of Babaraman in, but that to me seemed a very ill-conceived sort of reach in terms of a signing. It didn't seem like it was diligently processed by Chelsea. And yet, I think you look at that famous lone army that they've got and we keep hearing about, there's a lot of players that I think really you kind of have to trust and throw in there now. They couldn't, from what I can gather, get Andreas Christensen back. But there are a fair few players, maybe the likes of Pasalic, Chalobah, people like that. Granted, they wouldn't solve the fullback issue, but I think they could contribute now. And I think you have to show patience to that process. And that's my concern, is that when you do operate with that ruthlessness, do you really have the time to be patient, not just with a manager, but also with young players that will take time to bed in? Because that's one of the difficulties with Chelsea, I think, in the Abramovic era, is that it's been the equivalent of throwing players into a pool and seeing whether they sink or drown. Mm. Sorry, float or sink even.
Right.
Real quick,
Yeah, Morgan, of course.
No, I was just going to say, as far as the Ivanovic and the reason I think this is going to be his last year, again, you're getting Kurt Zouma back from injury, you're going to get Andy Christensen back, but I think that right now the purchase of Marcos Alonso is going to be the reason why. With Marcos Alonso coming in, hopefully they're going to bed him in, and they brought him in to put him at left back and then move Cesar Azpilicueta back to the right back position at that point, which is his natural position. I mean, he's a right back that's been playing spectacularly at left back for the last couple of years. So I think that's why you've seen the buy of Babar Rahman, even though it didn't turn out. I think that was the long-term goal, was to get Azpilicueta back to right back so that you could either move Ivanovic into the center or just get rid of him. Babar Rahman didn't turn out, so I don't think that's why you saw that last year. So we'll see, I guess, this year with Marcos Alonso, if he ends up. And again, he's a player that's played in Italy for a while. Antonio Conte has played against him. He did pretty well for Sunderland when he was there, and I'm sure Chris knows about that when he was at Sunderland. So I mean, I would say that in the long view, you're going to see a back situation of Azpilicueta and Alonso, hopefully, and then going forward, that should solve that and probably see Ivanovic get left in the dust.
So, gentlemen, we'll talk about Hull City, Arsenal, as well as Everton, Middlesbrough in a second. But listeners, if you enjoy the World Soccer Talk podcast and you'd like to support the pod, there are two ways you can help. First, you can give us a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you listen to us on. Second, you can sign up for a free 24-hour trial to our sponsors, FuboTV, the legal streaming service that brings you La Liga, Serie A, the Championship, and the League Cup. Speaking of the League Cup, you can watch the following League Cup games live and on demand with a 24-hour trial to FuboTV this week. On Tuesday, it's Leicester versus Chelsea. Then on Wednesday, it's favorites Northampton Town against minnows Manchester United, as well as Swansea versus Manchester City. Sign up today for the 24-hour trial at www.worldsoccertalk.com/FuboTV. Again, that's worldsoccertalk.com/FuboTV. Thanks for supporting the World Soccer Talk podcast. Chris, Hull, Arsenal, Hull have given a real good showing of what they can do with very limited resources. But Arsenal, after Arsenal scored that early goal, and Hull went down to 10 men before the break, they were always up against it, weren't they?
They were, and this was a funny game because I actually left it with the score at 2-1 and came back to watch it later on. And I came away from it thinking 2-1, that it's fairly respectable for a 10-man Hull side that is,
Right.
In a little bit of kind of turbulence at the minute. And then you go and see the full time score and you think, okay, that's a little bit of a shellacking, for want of a better word. I think, honestly, at this point, Hull just have to get Mike Phelan tied down. I think they need that stability. The longer that kind of rumbles on, I think the more detrimental it is to what they're trying to achieve. As an actual team, to kind of isolate that, I don't think they're a terrible bunch of players. I think the likes of Curtis Davis is a little bit underrated. I think there's a fairly solid British core there that will give them industry, if not always exceptional talent. And I think often that can win out. We've seen enough instances of teams that stayed up just because they outworked the opposition for 38 weeks of the season. And I think Hull could fall into that category. As for things from an Arsenal perspective, I completely see why the fans are delighted with that Xhaka goal. But on the same instance, it feels like a wonderfully Arsenal moment because it's a beautiful goal scored at a totally inconsequential time. So I think if he's going to do anything, it needs to be much like Pogba, to use that same yardstick, albeit a much shorter one because he costs a lot less. It needs to be in a big game for me. It needs to be at a really defining moment. That's where I need to see Granit Xhaka come to the fore.
Chris has so easily thrown shade at Arsenal, Manchester United, and Pogba in one sentence. Well done, Chris. Morgan, we have to talk about Granit Xhaka, don't we? You and I talked very briefly about this. Your thoughts, does he need to be starting every game?
I mean, I think so. There's no reason that you're buying him to kind of have him reinforce the bench. I mean, I think he's a pretty good talent. He obviously played very well last year for Borussia Mönchengladbach. At this point, I mean, you shelled out the money for him. You need to put him in. He's a good player. I think if they want him to grow, then he needs to get the playing time, not just coming off of the bench. Cleared out some guys like Mathieu Flamini and stuff like that. So why not put Xhaka in there? I mean, I think he'll do well.
I agree. I think this was a good game to have him start. I mean, it worked. I feel sometimes we do we hold Arsenal to a different standard than we do the other teams. Sure, the 4-1 did flatter them a little bit because 2-1, as Chris pointed out, it was really 2-1, and then they scored a couple of goals in the last 5 to 10 minutes, actually 5 minutes. But at the same time, it is a 4-1 win away from home. Maybe we should give them a little bit more credit, Chris.
No, I think you can. I think you're right, actually. In truth, there is, and I'm probably guilty of this myself, a little bit of kind of hyperbole attached to Arsenal in terms of whether you give them credit or you criticise them. I think certainly it was mission accomplished from that. I think in that respect, we need to give them a little bit more time, not just to bed in, but I think to just kind of assess where they are in this league. I think that's the difficulty, is that there's a lot of ambiguity about where Arsenal actually sit in this picture when we try and stack things up. And a lot of our estimations and predictions are rooted in, well, how much did they spend? And the truth is, comparative to the rivals they aspire to be alongside, you would argue not a great deal. They haven't had a huge wealth of players come in. In fact, the ones that did, they felt like marquee signings in the sense that they were the only ones through the door. And in fairness to Wenger, you know, I think he's dealt with that criticism quite well. I thought his point about Rob Holding was quite intelligent. And I think in that sense, we need them to have that test. And I think we're trying to work that out. Is it against a rival? Perhaps not. Maybe it's those difficult games at home, sort of in that winter period where they tend to slip up. That's where we need to kind of gauge them. Because at the minute, I don't think they're doing terribly. And equally, I also don't think the league is won at this point in the season. Yeah. I think it tends to come in that winter period that I was talking about.
Yeah, I agree. I love the Rob Holding thing. Had he been bought for 30 million, we'd be giving him more credit. So true. Morgan.
I think he said, yeah. I'm sorry he didn't cost 55 million.
That's what it was.
Which was the ultimate kind of passive aggressive shade, I think, that you can get from someone.
Very vintage Wenger too. Morgan, last point about this. Alexis Sanchez, I thought he was good today. He dragged Maguire and Curtis Davis, as well as Jake Livermore, out of position, to the point that if you look at their average positions, there was a huge gap between those two players, which is why Arsenal were able to cut through. But the question I have is Alexis Sanchez up top. I'm a little torn on that. In some ways, having the supporting cast he does with the likes of Ozil, Iwobi, etc., I think it could work, but I don't know. If you need some hold up play, that might not be the best bet. And I think he got away with it in this game because it was Hull City. But how do you feel about Alexis Sanchez playing as essentially a false nine?
I mean, you pretty much hit my point right on the head there. I think it's a tactic that'll work against some of the weaker sides in the league, some of the less disciplined sides in the league, because of all Sanchez's running, he can take guys out of position. He can, you know, he just drags people all over the park. And he's got the speed to just run all day. I think against some of the bigger sides, like, you know, if they're coming up against Man City, I think absolutely you need to put Giroud in there to hold up play a little bit and allow him a little bit more creativity to run around, you know, from a Giroud, you know, to get a Giroud pass or to have just somebody big up in there to bomb through on the center back. So I think it's something that, you know, if it's a way that he can work it out as a rotation, like, hey, you know, we're going to play Sunderland this week, let's go ahead and put Sanchez up top and give Giroud a rest. Absolutely, I think it's something that'll work out, but it's not something that I would be doing week in, week out, you know, every game of the year.
Got good points. Let's move ahead, Chris. Let's talk about Everton's win against Middlesbrough. All the goals in this game were in the first half. Everton came out of the box really hard. But I have to ask you about that Stecklenburg goal, Negredo's tackle on Stecklenburg, which led to the own goal. Strange decision for me. I thought it was a clear-cut foul on the goalkeeper. And the reason I bring it up, I don't really like to talk about goalkeeper referee decisions too often, but I'm wondering if we're starting to see maybe a reversion back to requiring goalkeepers to be a little more old school in that sense. Like you should be able to man up and take a tackle or two, because a tackle like that, as we've seen it given pretty much every other time in the, I don't know, last 100 games in the Premier League.
Yeah, I think there's two very hardline camps of thought on this one, which is goalkeepers are overprotected. Who will agree that goal was completely valid. I think there are also those who think that actually, you know, we need to afford goalkeepers protection, and we don't want sort of goals of yesteryear where you could bundle the goalkeeper over the line and celebrate. Personally, having watched it back a few times, I can almost see the arguments of both sides, and yet kind of come away thinking that Mr. Kellenberg, someone of his size, that kind of thing, he should be taking that fairly comfortably. Mm. Again, I'm certainly not voting for the idea that, again, you can start charging at goalkeepers recklessly. I thought it was a straight jump, personally, and the two of them have gone up for it, and Negredo's just managed to win out and get the ball in the goal. I think, in that sense, it's something that Coleman will need to watch, because Stig Ellenberg, you know, you go back to when he was at Ajax, really fantastic prospect. I was surprised when he chose to pick him up. I know that he knows him, so there's an understanding there. I think he had him at Southampton as well, which, again, helps that familiarity and transitioning away from Tim Howard, because I don't think Joel Robles is ready.
Right.
I just think he's got a mistake in him. That's the problem. I think too often he's got the ability to drop something and lead to something that should be routine, ending up being a goal for the opposition. And it's really not what you want from your starting goalkeeper.
Morgan, the players that kind of made up for that mistake from Stecklenburg are Gareth Barry, who scored, I think, his 56th goal in the Premier League. Seamus Coleman with a Messi-esque goal. And then Lukaku. Actually, I don't know who the goal was awarded to. Lukaku claimed it. I think it was a Bolasie cross, if I'm remembering that correctly. But the point I have is about Lukaku. He started the season fairly well again. As someone who saw him as a youngster when he first came to Chelsea, signing from where did he sign from? Did he sign from Vitesse?
No, he signed from Anderlecht, and they signed him and three of his brothers, Tika, Lamisha, and Charlie. Charlie's now on loan at Betis, if I remember right, and Charlie's actually a very big prospect.
Isn't there the defender brother who plays for Belgium, Jordan?
I'm thinking, no, you know what? I got the Masunda boys and Lukaku boys messed up. I'm sorry. Oh. Yeah, they did sign Lukaku from Anderlecht. Jordan now is he's in Serie A. I want to say, I can't remember exactly where he is, but they didn't sign him. Yeah, I'm sorry, because they signed all three of them within like a year or so of each other, or all four of those guys within a year or so of each other.
Chris, you want to correct
us? He's with Lazio.
Lazio, there we go.
That's right.
He signed for them in the summer.
Morgan, so Romelu Lukaku, thoughts on Romelu Lukaku's play at Everton so far? We haven't had a chance to talk to you about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, he's broken his goal drought four times now, so he hasn't gone hundreds of, you know, thousands of minutes without a goal. I mean, I think that, you know, he's a very, very good striker. He's somebody who I loved and adored watching him come up, watching him play on loan. I just, you know, him and Kevin De Bruyne will always be sore spots for me from that Mourinho takeover, because I just don't see how you could not use talents like that in pretty much any side. There's absolutely no reason for it. And, you know, I mean, you're seeing it now at Everton. I think that Coleman is going to use him very well. I think he's going to play very well again this year. I think he's got, what, the second most goals in the Premier League over the last, like, 3 years outside of where
Aguero, I think, yeah.
The numbers speak for themselves. You know, he's a striker that's, in my mind, you know, the guy that he always got compared to was Didier Drogba, because he was big, he was strong, he was fast, and the fact that Chelsea let that go the way they did, just because Mourinho didn't like him because he didn't take a penalty right in you know, in the Super Cup game, it's ridiculous. It's always going to be a sore subject with me, but I'm glad to see that he's playing well, and, you know, hopefully they'll break the bank and put out that $70 million and bring him back.
All right, let's. When we come back, we'll talk about Manchester City's win, Leicester's win, and talk about the incredible game that was West Brom versus West Ham United. Stay tuned for the part two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Chris, Leicester's win over Burnley, 3-0. I was watching this game. It was the game I focused on in the 10 a.m. kickoff here stateside yesterday. Leicester created some really good chances down the left, and that was primarily, and by the way, Mahrez missed a sitter. He should have buried one of the crosses Christian Fuchs sent in. And that's who I want to talk about, Chris. Christian Fuchs, we talked about him a little bit last year, but really wasn't one of those players that we highlighted because we tended to focus on, obviously, N'Golo Kanté and Drinkwater and Vardy and Mahrez. But how crucial has this guy been as both a creative force as well as keeping that defense compact down the left?
Honestly, when he signed, I didn't think he would bring much. I'll be very candid about it. I thought, you know, he's a middle-of-the-road fullback. He's been in the Bundesliga most of his career. If I remember rightly, he was exceptionally close to joining Sunderland. And having watched him again, there were the first few performances, I thought, you know, again, it's probably the same kind of thought, middle-of-the-road, not too terrible. I think, actually, he's a solid defender who can also contribute in the final third.
I think
he surprised me a little bit. I think what he does as well, he's at the stage of his career where he brings an experience and a calmness that I don't think you'll find elsewhere in that squad. I mean, Jeffrey Schlupp is sort of this weird, versatile, almost modern player who can play anywhere on that left side. And yet, I think if I had the choice between the two, I'd go for Fuchs every day of the week. I didn't mean that to sound how it came out. But yeah, I think I would choose him first because I think he just
I think we're having some trouble with your audio, Chris. Yeah, Chris, we're gonna get you back on as soon as we can. Morgan, your thoughts on Christian Fuchs?
Can I just say that's the classic Chris? He makes an exceptional point, brings more insight to anybody else, and then he's failed by the connection. Guarantee you that Wi-Fi. Answer of the year, 10 times better than anything I could come up with on the spot, and we lost it because of Skype. Thank you, Skype.
Thank you, Skype.
You know, again, I think, you know, like Chris said, Christian Fuchs is a guy who, you know, he did. He played in the Bundesliga for his whole career, not really a superstar, not somebody who would end up on your, you know, top 10 lists of left backs in the whole world.
Right.
But I think that, you know, Ranieri, when he bought him, had an idea for him in mind. And just, I think Ranieri did a very good job of putting him in positions to succeed. But I think also that, you know, he instilled a confidence in Fuchs, and we've seen that. You know, we've seen that with his performances. He's played really, really well, really, really consistently over, you know, obviously over the championship season. He's played very well this year. So I think, you know, out of all the signings, you know, if it wasn't for N'Golo Kanté, I think that, you know, Fuchs would be that, you know, that one signing that everybody's kind of pointing to as the most underrated signing for Leicester.
Morgan, let's actually move ahead, since I think what Chris was trying to say was we got what we needed to out of that. But let's try to move ahead to talking about City versus Bournemouth. I mean, there are not enough superlatives to how quickly Guardiola has manifested his tactical ideas onto this team. And we won't get a better example of that than that second goal. I mean, you could watch that counterattack all day. There's a clearance from a defensive set piece. There's a counterattack involving fast buildup, really fast buildup, yet not a single pass is played long. It's all short passes, all interchange of position, and then a perfectly weighted critical through pass from De Bruyne leads to Sterling opening up and knocking the ball past back to Iheanacho. So just, I mean, what are your thoughts on this Manchester City team? Because even as someone who, I don't know how to frame this, as someone who should be disliking them as a Man United supporter, I can't help but look at this team and think nothing but admiration.
Well, I think you need to look back. I mean, this is a Manchester City team that's been building for this year. They've been building for the coming of Pep Guardiola since they, you know, kind of signed that deal with the devil with the Barcelona boys that they all brought in their front office.
Right.
So, you know, I think a lot of the signings that you've seen, especially over the last year when it became pretty apparent that Pep wasn't going to be staying at Bayern, and you know, I guarantee you there was some collusion in him saying, yeah, I'm probably, this is my last year here, and then I'll come there. So this is a team that Pep was able to come into and already get started. I think the Raheem Sterling signing was the first one that off into that. I think that, really there wasn't a whole lot for him to do. He didn't have to go out and buy a bunch of key players and then try and bed them in. A lot of the key players have already been there at least for one season. So, it's really good. I mean, they came in, they already have pretty much a good idea of how Pep plays. They're players that play in systems that are similar to how Pep plays. They have the qualities that Pep looks for, and that's why I think you've seen such a seamless transition from the Pellegrini era to the Pep Guardiola era, which is obviously going to be a lot more successful in the Pellegrini era, in my opinion, to why they're playing as well as they are. And plus, a guy like Kevin De Bruyne in any team doesn't hurt, and it hurts me to say that.
Chris, Kevin De Bruyne, after the game, Guardiola said that he feels Kevin De Bruyne is one of the better players he's worked with. I remember him saying Lahm was the most intelligent player he's worked with, and people were up in arms about it because, he'd worked with Messi and Busquets and Xavi and Iniesta. But what Guardiola is getting at is an intelligence on the pitch that De Bruyne shows that sets him apart from maybe more technically gifted players.
Yeah, he said, I believe he said something along the lines of Messi sits on a table of his own and Kevin sits on the table next to him. Which I think is a wonderful way to put it. I think this is what we're perhaps starting to learn with Guardiola, now having him week in, week out, is perhaps some things need a pinch of salt. That's not to downgrade De Bruyne's performances. I think they've been brilliant since the season started. I think it's more the things like saying Kolarov played the best game he'd seen from a centre-back, things like that feel a little bit hyperbolic. I think in relation to De Bruyne, he has been the star turn for them this season. I think he was very impressive last season as well. For me, the most important improvement or most impressive improvement since he arrived is Raheem Sterling's form. I think he's turned into a player that can now actually produce. And it hasn't necessarily been working on his deficiencies as much in terms of his finishing, but actually getting him into positions where he can pass the ball, he can square it off and give it to players in much better positions to score. I think that's what's improved his game dramatically. There was an instance, in fact, in that game where I think last season you see him try to take that one-on-one and he likely fluffs it, whereas this time around he was in a position where he could square it to a teammate and just takes the pressure off him, and he seems to be playing with a lot less pressure in general.
Yeah, his finishing is still a little suspect, isn't it? He had that great run in this game, went past three or four players, and then his finishing let him down again. But as you said, he looks rejuvenated. He looks like he cares again. And perhaps, Morgan, it comes back to that adage we have about Guardiola, that once you get into the final attacking third, he allows his players to have a lot more freedom than people usually think he does. And maybe that's what Sterling is thriving on right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think a player like Raheem Sterling absolutely needed a guy like Pep Guardiola, with all the stick that he's gotten from the Manchester City fans from last year, and then obviously the England team over the summer. He needed somebody to come in and say, look, I want you to go out and do you. I want you to be as creative as you possibly can. Do what is your strengths. You can work on the deficiencies later, but for right now, you need to do what's your strength. And I think playing to his strengths is what's going to give him the confidence to build up and then work on those deficiencies. So, I couldn't agree with you more there. And I think allowing him that creative freedom just gives him all the more confidence. The finishing, will it come? Who knows? It may never come. I mean, he may never be a 15, 20 goal a year guy, but if he's setting up, 20, 25 goals a year, then who cares?
Chris, while the Leicester City game was going on, I had the scores turned off for the other games because I wanted to watch the highlights and not know what happened. And a friend of mine texted me and said, what is going on with West Brom? And I looked, I went to SoccerNet, saw that West Brom were leading 4-0. There are surprises in my life. And then there's this. How did that happen, Chris? How did West Brom go 4 goals up on West Ham?
I'd love to give you a conclusive answer to that one. I'm sure if you asked Tony Pulis, he would say that a good portion of that is the recruits he was able to bring in late in the window, because he's consistently talked about wanting those attacking players. And I think for a lot of people, self included, it was seen as an excuse for why the team was performing poorly. Mm-hmm. I'm also keen not to make one swallow be a summer on this, because I think, much like Crystal Palace, it's a solid win. I think you'll not see me say anything other than that. It's that consistency again, though. This is a West Ham team that, for me, is chronically out of form, has started the season perhaps even worse than they could have planned it themselves, in terms of going out of Europe, in terms of just not settling at the Olympic Stadium. I think, in general, this is a team that is suffering a real sophomore slump under Slaven Bilic. And it's typified by the goals as well. You look at where they're occurring. They're all in, for me, areas that you should be defending. Areas where your ball, where the ball shouldn't be allowed to bounce if you are trying to keep that clean sheet. And again, you know, it's no surprise that high quality players are taking relatively solid chances in the Premier League. Those are kind of the cardinal sins that you get warned not to make when you enter this league. And for some reason, West Ham are making them. I think the bigger concern right now for me is West Ham and how they move forward with this, because there seems to be a genuine negative cloud forming at that football club, because it's not even just on-field things. It's off-field things too that are really turning the fan base against the club.
Morgan, Chris is absolutely right, because those goals were three of those goals, at least, were self-inflicted by West Ham. A silly PK, a handball, silly giveaway, trying to play out of the back as if they're Barcelona. The fourth goal, fair enough. It was a good break start by Dan Fletcher involving Rondon and Chadli. I just feel like there's something bigger going on at West Ham. But here's the thing. They did come back into the game. Another Antonio header brought them back into the game from a Payet cross. We don't give Antonio enough love as one of the best headers of the ball in the Premier League. So I guess it's tough to contextualize this game, because it looked like when they went back to 4-2, it looked like West Ham would come back and actually maybe even win this game. Yet, as soon as they went up 4-2, I think that was the last chance they created. That was probably in the 62nd, 63rd minute. So it's so hard to understand what this West Ham team is doing, because there's so much talent on that team, yet they're just not delivering.
Well, and I had pegged West Ham as my regression candidate this year, just because, you know, I think that under Slaven Bilic with his managerial...
By the way, that's regression, not relegation. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. That's okay, regression, sorry. Not relegation. No. There's a difference there. Yeah. You know, I don't think they're bad. They're obviously not bad enough to get relegated. But, you know, I just don't think they're going to hit the heights that they hit last year. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, mid-table, maybe a little bit further down from that, might be more realistic for them this year with the way that things are going. I think Bilic is a manager who, at least from with my tracking of him, has had immediate success when he's gotten there and then had that sophomore slump the second year. Why? I'm not exactly sure. It happened at Besiktas.
Does it feel like we're saying this pretty much about every manager these days, though, Morgan? Like, every manager does well when they initially get there, and then the second season syndrome. Maybe this is just the state of football now.
And it may very well be. I mean, it may very well be that. I think with the turnover of players, there's a lot that comes into there. You have guys that come in, they're taken over from, you know, managers who had their own system and their own style. They play with what they have, and then a manager goes out and buys his own guys, and it doesn't turn out quite as well. You know, the second season syndrome is happening a lot. Obviously, at Chelsea, the second season syndrome ended up in the title, but then the third, it ended up very badly. So, you know, just to achieve year after year after year success, like what we saw with Manchester United, like what we saw with Arsenal, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, like what we saw kind of with Chelsea, those 2-3 years there in the mid 2000s. I don't know that it's something that is going to be around for a while. I think that teams are very quick to adapt these days to the styles of new managers. And I think that that's what you're seeing here with Bilic too. I think you're seeing teams adapt to the style that West Ham play. They're adapting to and knowing that Dimitri Payet basically everything runs through that team, so you're seeing guys trying to nullify his impact. And once you do that, there's not a whole lot else in that West Ham team, aside from if they did a lucky cross to Mikel Antonio that they could do.
A lucky cross to Mikel Antonio. I'm sure a lot of West Ham fans are yelling at you right now. So at this point, let me give you, let me update our listeners on results around Europe. After game week 3 in Germany, Bayern continued their perfect record after beating Ingolstadt 3-1. Although the play on the field was much closer than the scoreline actually ended up suggesting. The big talking point this week in Germany, however, was a young US men's national team international that no one on soccer Twitter is talking about, Christian Pulisic, who scored and provided 2 assists a day before his 18th birthday. Morgan, what were you doing when you turned 18?
The day I turned 18, I went to a 7-Eleven, I bought a lotto ticket, a pack of cigarettes, and a Playboy magazine just because of I then drank very, very cheap beer that night, and then I enrolled in culinary art school.
I am so angry with myself for asking you that. In Ligue 1, after its 5 games played, Monaco continued their excellent start to the season, while much maligned Edison Cavani scored 4 goals, meaning PSG won by 6 goals. In Spain, Barcelona and Atletico Madrid scored 5 goals on Lehans and Sporting Gijón respectively, with Real Madrid just having kicked off at the time of recording. Finally, in Serie A, Lazio, Milan and Napoli all recorded wins, while the big game of the week played out with Inter beating Juventus, surprisingly, 2-1 at home. When we come back for part 3, we'll talk about the rest of the games in the league, in the Premier League, as well as give you our top 4s and our players of the week. Stay tuned for section 3 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Part 3 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Chris, let's start with top 4s. Mine, I'm going to do mine first. Manchester City, I still have Man United. I think at this point that's a stupid prediction. Tottenham in third, Chelsea in fourth. Give me your top 4s, Chris.
I think it's City, Man United, Liverpool, Tottenham.
Morgan?
I'm going to go with City, and I'm going to surprise a couple people with mine. I'm going to go with Arsenal second.
What?
Second. Everton third, Chelsea fourth.
You have City, Arsenal, Everton, and Chelsea.
Yes, sir.
Morgan is back on the World Soccer Talk podcast, guys. Tweet at him. All right, Morgan, we'll start with you for our player of the week.
My player of the week, Juan Camilo Zuniga, runner-up Islam Slimani.
Oh, goodness. We're going to have to talk about Watford, aren't we? Chris, your player of the week.
I'm going to go for Christian Pulisic.
Wait a minute. Player of the week. Well, wait a minute. Don't be cheating, Chris.
Oh, is it exclusively the Premier League?
Yes. This is pretty much exclusively a Premier League podcast. For all intents and purposes.
Okay. With that said, then I will say that the player of the week for me is Nasser Chadli.
All right. By the way, Chris, I didn't get to ask you what were you doing on your 18th birthday?
I think if I remember right, I went for a beer with my dad in a pub, and then I think I had school the next day, so I couldn't actually be out too late.
Morgan, you see that? He was being respectful and following the law, because Britain, he can drink at 18.
I had school that day.
You were drunk at school.
I probably was. I know I did a shot before school.
Morgan, I'm kicking you off the podcast. My player of the week was Kevin De Bruyne for reasons stated. He was absolutely brilliant and had his hand in every single goal that Manchester City scored. Let's talk about this one game that happened. I don't know. I blacked out during it, Chris. Watford beating Manchester United 3-1. Chris, I remember a time, a glorious time, before the international break, when I was so happy. Manchester United had won 3 games. Pogba was playing well. He'd signed. Ibrahimovic was scoring every game. International break happens. Lose to City. Lose midweek in the Europa League. Lose today to Watford. 3 losses in a week. What is going on, Chris?
And I hate to jump on a potential bandwagon here and say that I think Wayne Rooney is the problem.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with you.
I think he's the only problem. I think there are a variety of others. Mm-hmm. See, I think he's the most pressing concern, though. And the thing is, it is quite popular to have a go at him and sort of lump blame on him. And I understand why that is. I think we have a bizarre fascination with tearing down those who are at the top and waiting for that first slip to do so. The thing is with him, physically, he hasn't taken care of his body, I think, during his career.
Well, I have to say his hair looks great, so there's that. He took care of that.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue there's a microcosm for the problem, is he's been far more focused on the kind of external and the internal. And look, it's come to that point where something that was, I would argue, a foundation to his game, which was the ability to be explosive and burst past players and use physical presence to his advantage. The absence of that relative to those around him, or the diminishment of that, has now severely impacted the way he plays. And he doesn't look a world-class player at this precise moment. And honestly, I don't think this is form. I think this is ability at this point. Yeah. I think he's not a player that will regenerate and have this resurgence. You could then, if you wanted to go down that rabbit hole, debate whether he ever really was world-class, or was he a player that had world-class tendencies now and again. I think for the benefit of this, we'll stick to the fact that he's just not good enough for that team, and he's actually, I would say, quite an inhibitor in their ability to play even remotely free-flowing football. And I think, honestly, there are the likes of Martial and other players that I think come into that team and do a much better job and give them something that is much more conducive, not just to giving the team success, but I think work better with the likes of Zlatan as that attacks figurehead. So it's up to Mourinho whether he does it. He's often been someone who is all about winning and the ruthlessness. And I wonder if perhaps in taking this job, he underestimated where Wayne Rooney was in terms of his career trajectory, and that now he's learning the hard way that he's simply not usable or serviceable as a player in the starting 11.
Here are my quick thoughts on Rooney, Morgan, before I come to you. It's one of those things where I have a little bit of sympathy with Mourinho, in the sense that Mourinho has had this track record of him wanting to play with these marquee, or manage these marquee English players like Gerrard and Lampard and Terry, and he sees them as the purveyors and the distributors of his message throughout the team. So I think that's why he trusts Rooney. But the problem, as Chris mentioned, I think any objective person will say that Wayne Rooney does not deserve to be starting for Man United. I think we are at that point now that is beyond contestation. Anyone will agree with that. What I fail to understand is, looking, if Mourinho is smart, and he looks at Rooney's history under Sir Alex during times when he was the best, playing his best, Sir Alex made sure to drop Rooney when Rooney was out of form, because Sir Alex understood that Rooney played his best when he felt like he had a point to prove. For the last three seasons, ever since David Moyes took over at Man United, Rooney is the only player on the team, the only player on the team whose place has not been under question. And I think that's why he gives 4 out of 10 performances over and over again. Just as a thought, just as one experiment, I'd like to see Mourinho come out in the press and say he dropped Rooney for a game and see what happens. At worst, Morgan, mm-hmm. Rooney can't do any worse than he's doing right now.
I agree. I think that one thing that we may be overlooking on here is that Sir Alex Ferguson was so entrenched in United by the time Rooney got there that he had the clout to be able to drop Rooney. He could look at him and say, all right, you're dropped, and it doesn't matter, because what Sir Alex says goes, because he was the end all be all.
Right.
Now that we're in the post Ferguson era, I don't think that a lot of these managers, like, Moyes and Van Gaal, were given the ability to drop Rooney because of the fact that, at least from an ownership standpoint, he's the face of United. He's the guy that everybody
thinks
of.
Is he though?
He was.
He may. He was, but I mean, last season, the buzz for all Man United players were, 2 seasons ago, we were talking about Falcao and Angel Di Maria. We were talking last season about Schweinsteiger. Sure, that didn't go brilliantly well, or whatever that is. The point is that I don't think we are at a point where Rooney is the face of Manchester United. And I don't get this obsession with Rooney from the managers.
This is the thing, is that I think that he's the corporate face of Man United. I'm not saying that he's the playing face of Man United. There's a difference here. That's the biggest difference. Wayne Rooney is the one that they put out there because he's English-speaking, because he's British. He's the one that can move product. He's the one that can move shirts. He's the one that can move Chevys, whatever. You know, he's the spokesperson for Man United, and I think that's the reason why you're seeing these owners that really want him out there. And I think that there is some undermining coming in from the ownership that they want him to play just because of that fact. Now, with Mourinho coming in, a manager who has had massive success in his career up till last season, you know, he's somebody who is seen as having the clout to be able to look at Wayne Rooney and say, you're not doing a good job. I want to drop you. He can do that. He has that ability. The question is, will he be allowed to do that by the higher ups on there? And I think at this point, I don't think they're allowing him to do that.
So, Chris, last point on this. Let me take off my Man United hat for a second and do my job as a host and play devil's advocate. So in questioning my own assumptions about Rooney, I went to Squawker, Optostat, sorry. And you and I actually have talked about this off air before about how we kind of get tired with this over-reliance on stats. But trying to be objective, I went to Optostats and looked at Rooney's pass completion, all that stuff. What I noticed was Rooney's pass percentage was excellent in his own half and exceptionally bad in the latter half, in Watford's half. Is Rooney being, are we expecting Rooney to play a more attacking role than he is capable of? When I see Fellaini, so to give you a comparison, because every experiment has to have a control, I look at Fellaini from today's game. Fellaini's pass completion, almost 100%, because all those passes were in his own half. So had Fellaini been trying to play that Rooney role, I'm sure his pass percentage would have been lower. Are we expecting a little bit way too much out of Rooney because it's Rooney?
No, I would say not in the slightest. I think he is on, what is it, 300,000 a week at this precise moment. So when you earn that kind of money, when you demand that kind of money, and I think in that respect he set himself up for a fall when he demanded they sign, in inverted commas, world-class players, he has to produce. And I think it would be far too easy to say that we're expecting too much. I think he built this pedestal for himself. This was not necessarily something that those around him put him onto. It was something he constructed with his demands that he placed on the club, both financially and in terms of the direction they were moving in.
Fair enough. I guess let's move on from this, because we've spent a lot of time at United and haven't even talked about the fact that Watford were very good today. Morgan Kapui scored a goal and has continued his exceptional form at the start of the season. And what I found amazing was, here talking about stats, because I guess this is funny because it's the first time I actually looked at all these stats. Watford had 60% possession at the end of the first half against Manchester United. That in itself tells you everything you need to know about Mourinho and the status of Manchester United's play. But sorry, let's focus on Watford, who had a very good game.
They did, and you know, you kind of saw it from the awful, was it the 13th minute when De Gea and Smalling kind of had their little mishap. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Igalo last year probably buries that goal, and it gets even worse for United. You know, they played well. Watford, I think, are a team that is going to play really well. Mazzarri is a very, very good manager. I think he knows now how to set that team up. And I think that they're going to be kind of right around there, around mid-table, a little higher, and they're going to give the higher teams a run for their money. I mean, they were beating Chelsea at one point. So I think that, they're a very dangerous team. And we knew that last year under Kiki Sanchez-Flores. But again, I mean, they do. They've got really good players. Etienne Capoue has been fantastic for them ever since he signed, ever since he got out of the out of that Spurs, I guess, lull, you could say, for him. He's been scoring goals. Troy Deeney is a fantastic striker. He got all the fantastic. Going forward, I think, Watford's going to be somebody to contend with. I don't think that they're going to be the pushovers that everybody remembers them being, you know, from the last time that they were up and previously.
Chris, let's talk to you now about Palace Stoke City. I think we all on the World Soccer Talk podcast tend to be a little persnickety when it comes to Alan Pardew. But since the Tottenham loss, they won in the Football League Cup second round against Blackpool, a draw against Bournemouth that arguably they should have won had Zaha put away some chances, beat Middlesbrough last week, won very comfortably, albeit mostly through set pieces, against Stoke City today. Tell me your feelings on Alan Pardew right now.
I think you're finding someone who is slowly putting together the kind of style that works best for him and his understanding of the game. I think he's someone that relies heavily on wide players, someone that actually would like to make more of set pieces. I mean, in my experience, he hasn't been particularly fantastic with them. In fact, there was a decent period at his last club where they didn't score from a set piece. But I think in signing Benteke, that really was kind of the last piece of the puzzle for them, because that was someone who could convert those crosses and those opportunities. I think there will be moments where it clicks, like it did against Stoke. I think there will also be moments of frustration. I think what you'll see with Palace this season, realistically, is a team that manages to flick between the two poles of extreme in that sense.
Morgan, your thoughts on Stoke City at this point? They've had a very poor start. Before the game, I think Mark Hughes was talking about contextualizing the first three results, was talking about how they'd played some difficult opposition, had played away from home. This was another game away from home, but they really looked completely out of it. There was no chance creation. It wasn't as though Crystal Palace only scored from set pieces. They created other chances on the break. And honestly, that Arnautovic blinder, which he tends to score, came out of nowhere. And they didn't even deserve that one goal.
They didn't. And I think what you're seeing here is the kind of death throes of Mark Hughes at Stoke. You know, I mean, with a team that's spent as much money as they have and the team that he's assembled, that's a good team. I mean, that really is a good Stoke team. They should be comfortably mid-table, shouldn't have to worry about any sort of relegation or anything like that. But I just think that Sparky has outweighed or outstayed his welcome at Stoke. I really think that that's the biggest problem that we're having on here, and I think he's probably going to be the first managerial guy to get the sack this season. I think that if they're smart, they'll probably end up getting rid of him soon. Stoke have spent a lot of money since they've been in the Premier League, and I think going down for them will be a death knell for that club.
Speaking of going down, Chris, the game that I was watching when these two teams were playing was Southampton against Swansea. One of the greatest, most confusing things that happened this weekend was how Southampton only won by one goal, because they were absolutely dominant against Swansea. Had it not been for chances that Shane Long, Charlie Austin, Redmond, all of them missed, I'm not exaggerating when I think when I say that I think Southampton could have won by 6, 7, 8 goals in this game.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before, that the idea that Swansea could be in a lot of trouble this season.
To be fair, you were the first one to talk about it, but Karthik and I were kind of skeptical of that. I think you were on this before most other people were.
Yeah, which I feel like I deserve extra points for boldness given the gaffer support. So
yeah, that's right.
No, I think ultimately what surprised me about them was their willingness to let go of consistent performers and players that had realistically put them in the position that they'd been in their pomp in at least recent years. And the lack of what to me seemed like planning in signing their replacements. A lot of the moves seemed reactionary rather than preemptive, which is a little bit of a surprise given the way that Swansea have operated since they came into the top flight. For me, they've always been a club that's been not just run from a business standpoint, from a financial standpoint, but they've been one that's been diligent in the process of tending to its squad and planning for that future. And, you know, you look at maybe some of the players who could come in, the likes of Alfie Mawson, who doesn't have any top flight experience, who really managed to sort of fix his career at Barnsley, but then again had not done a great deal outside of, I want to say, the third tier of English football. that's not the kind of player that you think will come in and have a huge impact. And that's before you even look at things at the other end of the field where they need to start really scoring some goals if they're going to get out of this trouble.
Yeah, while you were talking, I realized that it's actually the gaffer's birthday. So it must have been heartbreaking. Happy birthday, gaffer, first of all. And it must be heartbreaking for him to have watched. Yeah, happy birthday from all of us at World Soccer Talk. I have to say that this was the first time that I felt that Southampton, coming back to Southampton, clearly missed Graziano Pelle as well as Sadio Mane. It's the first time I've thought that this season, just a number of chances they missed. Morgan, let's switch to the last game we'll talk about tonight, which is Tottenham-Sunderland. 1-0 win for Tottenham. First of all, I really like those pink away jerseys for Sunderland. I saw a lot of people on Twitter not big fans of those. What do you guys think about those? I quite like those.
I think that Rob Harris on Twitter really hit the nail on the head, and that Sunderland are doing their best to try and stay in the league by switching their colors to the official Premier League colors.
Oh, I see. That's well done. Chris, what do you think about those?
I've got no concerns about children in Sunderland playing out late at night because I don't think cars will miss them in those kits.
Those are bright, aren't they? So, Morgan, the talking point here from the starting 11 for Tottenham was Chris Karthik and I have talked about Janssen a lot and how he might fit in with Kane. He really struggled last week. He was dropped today with the Dembele, Wanyama, Dele Alli triumvirate in midfield, playing behind Kane and Heung-min Son on the left and Sissoko from the right. Did it worked in the sense that they had lots of shots from distance, but honestly, it wasn't until probably the 40th minute or something where they created a real clear-cut chance that led to a shot on goal to Tottenham.
No, you're right. And, I mean, I watched this game today. Tottenham really battered Sunderland's goal from distance. But you're right, they didn't create a whole lot of chances. Sunderland actually should have been up if it wasn't Steven Pienaar.
That Januzaj cross, he should have buried that.
He should have. I mean, there is no reason for that. That, again, kind of points to the fact that there's a reason why Steven Pienaar was a free agent.
Right.
I think that the whole game, really, I mean, they did. It seemed like they had the pressure on. They were in Sunderland's half a lot. They were doing a lot of chances from distance. The ones that they did off of set pieces, Jordan Pickford did a very, very good job in goal. And really, I mean, this, in all fairness, this probably should have been a 0-0 draw for Sunderland if it weren't for that horrible, horrible defensive error from Papi Gilabogi, who I will again add that Chelsea actually made a profit on when they sold him to Sunderland. That was his second one of the game. He had another one in the first half where it was a ball in the box off of a set piece that everybody missed. It came right down to him, and he just whiffed on the kick. He did the same thing here, except this time Harry Kane was there. To really pounce on it. And I mean, that, you know, that right there just kind of shows, I mean, it comes down to one mistake and then you're done. So if it wasn't for that one mistake, this should have been a draw for Sunderland. I don't think that, for all the long distance chances, for all the possession, for all of the time that they spent in Sunderland's half, I don't think Tottenham looked very good in that sense.
I can't wait till Chelsea buys back Gilabogi for like 600 million, and we'll talk to you about that then.
Castle for 8 million.
Yeah. Chris, final question. No Pogba stuff, Morgan. Stop it. Chris, final question about tonight, about this game. I think it was game week 2 where you and I were talking about that awesome header that Lamela scored, where he ran across the box and had that brave header that I forget who they played, but it was one of the only goals in the game. And we were talking about how Lamela really needs to kick on. Hasn't happened, and he is sort of reverting back to the inconsistency. He was dropped today, but even midweek didn't have the best game. So are you concerned about Eric Lamela going back to an inconsistency that we've come to associate with him almost?
A little bit. I think that the expectation has changed with him in terms of what he delivers and the influence he can have over proceedings in general. And I think there's maybe a little bit of a growing pain with that, in the sense of there was a period where he was seen as a bust financially. And I think in a bizarre way, that perception gave him a freedom to perform that maybe he didn't have when he first arrived. And I think at the minute, even watching the game on Sunday, I thought in the 10 or so minutes he had, he actually did more than a lot of those who had started the game. Mm. Don't think it's fair to single anyone out, as much to say that he could have had a solid case for starting off the back of it. I also think that someone in his position would be expected to do something every game. And actually, right. that clash against Monaco that you're referring to, there wasn't really anyone, I think, who came out with a glowing report card off the back of it. I think there was a lot of mediocrity in that performance from Tottenham. So I think, as yet, it's a minor dip. I don't think it's enough to think it's a chasm in terms of his performance.
Listeners, there's lots of football coming up, lots for you to watch, including next week's games. And we'll be back after those games to talk more football with you, with Chris, Morgan, Karthik. Make sure you get on iTunes, leave us a review. And on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, I want to thank both Chris and Morgan for joining me. And I bid you to enjoy your football.